walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest today is Francis Batista, a co-founder of Breast Best Friends Animal Society, who helped launch a No-Kill Los Angeles initiative with the City of Los Angeles, involving a coalition of some 70 organizations, which has cut nearly in half the number of healthy or treatable dogs and cats killed in LA shelters in just 2 years. We'll find out more about that's the sort of success, the challenges of achieving it, and how this sort of program might be replicated in other cities around the country when we speak with Francis Batista in a few moments here on Talking Animals. By the way, if you'd like to get a sneak preview of who our guests will be, and who wouldn't? People are clamoring for this information. We'd be happy to send you our weekly email newsletter, which announces who the forthcoming guests will be and sometimes other fascinating news from the world of talking animals. To subscribe, head to our website, talkinganimals.net, and on the right-hand side, near the top, look for subscribe to the newsletter. You just enter your email and you're done. It takes about 5 seconds. Thanks. Right now, let's hear our opening animal song. This is Laura Veers with The Fox on Talking Animals.
The fox went out on a chilly night, and he prayed for the moon to give him light. He had many a mile to go that night before he reached the town. Town, many a mile to go that night before he reached the town. He ran till he came to the farmer's pen. The ducks and the geese were kept therein. He said, a couple of you gonna grease my chin before I leave. Flipper-flopper jumped out of bed. Out of the window she popped her head, crying, John, John, the great goose is gone and the fox is on the town. Town, oh, town, oh, John, John, the great goose is gone and the fox is on the town, oh. He ran till he came to his nice warm den, and there were little ones, 8, 9, 10, crying, Dad, Dad, you better go back again, for it must a mighty fine town, oh, town, oh, town, oh, Dad, Dad, you better go back again, for it must be a mighty fine town, oh. The fox and his wife, without any strife, cut up the goose with the carving knife. Never had such a meal in their life, and the little ones chewed on the bones, oh, bones, oh, bones, oh. Never had such a meal in their life, and the little ones chewed on the bones, oh.
That was Laura Veers with The Fox, a little thing animal tune to get us started this morning. Let's move right into our chat with Francis, with a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf.org. Let's welcome Francis Batista back to Talk Animals. Good morning, Francis.
Good morning, Duncan, and thank you very much for inviting me to be on.
Yeah, well, long time listeners might remember you were a very early guest on Talking Animals when the show was truly in the formative stage. In fact, I checked, and you were on 10 years ago, almost to the day, March 15th, 2004. So you'll be happy to know I'm starting to get the hang of the show, so that's good.
And I'm not dead yet.
Okay, well, two good pieces of news then. But we do have, obviously, a lot of catching up to do. And for example, just to create a little sort of bit of backdrop and context for the conversation we'll have shortly about No Kill LA, let's start by asking you just to provide a little overview of Best Friends Animal Society. What is it, and what do you consider its chief missions to be?
Well, Best Friends is a National Animal Welfare Organization. We began, this is our 30th anniversary, actually. We began as a group of us started this sanctuary in southern Utah in 1984, really in the middle of nowhere with doing shelter rescue. And it kind of just blew up from the point of view of being something that captured people's imagination and attention. Over the years, it's grown and developed a national reach and programs in various cities around the country, and our national conference, which was in Florida this past year. So our mission is, our formal mission, according to the charter, is to bring about a time of no more homeless pets. Our day-to-day work focuses exclusively on ending shelter killing. And so everything that, all the programs that we do, all the work that's done, everything we invest in, has to point to have some impact on that result. So that's kind of where what our bottom line is.
Yeah, so that's the thing, because I think, you know, I imagine at least the people who are familiar with Best Friends, many of them think of the sort of sprawling sanctuary in Utah, and maybe the place that took in many of the Michael Vick dogs. But yeah, I doubt a lot of folks have an awareness of just how sort of broadly Best Friends operates these days, which you've sort of touched on. And sort of as a Best Friends honcho, you've been based in L.A. for some time, handling outreach and other things for Best Friends. Talk a little bit about the Best Friends activities there just over time, and then we'll, of course, get into more specifically No Kill LA.
Sure, and just to round out the first question, we currently have, boots on the ground in Los Angeles, across, in Utah, obviously, and we have programs in Albuquerque, San Antonio, Baltimore, Atlanta. We sponsor programs in Jacksonville and in New York. So we have quite a reach, as you say. Now, Los Angeles was one of our first cities where we landed beyond the sanctuary back in the early 90s. And at the time, we were really building out the sanctuary and involving people in that work. But as we did that, we also built volunteer programs in Los Angeles, and over time developed a very deep relationship with the community, both from the point of view of our membership and support, but also a relationship with the rescue community. We started doing super adoptions there and developed kind of the model, the super adoption model in Los Angeles that Best Friends has rolled out to a number of cities around the country. And we also have worked with LA Animal Services, and both from a point of view of rescue, but also helping them build some of their programs, and got grants to hire volunteer coordinators and that sort of thing to try and again move the mission forward. 2010, I'm one of the founders, and as a founder, I'm kind of out of the day to day operations from that point of view. I do internal consulting and work with our various departments. But in Los Angeles, I'm kind of a subject expert. And in 2010, we started working with the new head of LA Animal Services there, Brenda Barnett, who was also looking for a partner, and we were looking for a partner. I mean, we'd had various kind of false starts at trying to create some type of program to really impact shelter killing in Los Angeles over time. But the situation with the city there had been, that was really a revolving door. So when Brenda arrived in 2010, she was the seventh general manager or interim general manager from 2000. So since 2000 to 2010, there were seven different general managers for LA Animal Services.
Yeah.
And so nothing would ever get any traction. It just and it was a very contentious environment, and a lot of taking a lot of flack from all quarters. But Brenda, I think everybody was ready to sort of put the guns down and give somebody a chance, and Brenda really fit that bill. She was looking for us. You know, she was a disciple of Rich Avanzino. She'd worked with him at San Francisco SPCA during the heyday of that program in the 90s. She was the development director under him in the late 90s prior to his leaving for Maddie's Fund. And she then went on to ARF, you know, in the Bay Area, and then Posados and Seattle and Maine and various other things before coming down. So she had a good background and was really embedded in the whole no-kill concept. When she spoke to Rich, says, you know, hey, give me some advice. I'm going into this, going into L.A. He said, get in touch with best friends. So she did, and we were looking for her as well. So we then pulled together a steering committee to, based on the model of the work we've done in Utah, because we set up a no-kill coalition in Utah in 2000. So the model that we implemented in Los Angeles was really based on the work that had been done in Utah, that we had very excellent relations with the folks on different angles, different ends of the rescue community in Los Angeles. So we were able to really bring in a variety of folks and a lot of variety of perspectives. So now we have the NKLA coalition, which includes about 75 organizations, and is really making some tremendous progress.
Covered a lot of ground there, Francis. Actually, just backing up before you got even into the specifics of teaming with Brendan stuff, just because some people listening might wonder about the term. Early on, you mentioned super adoptions, and while some people might be picturing capes and superheroes, what does super adoptions actually refer to?
Well, a super adoption really is we best friends will produce an event that we invite others to participate in. So we will we'll rent the park, we'll get the tent and the permit and do the promotion and the advertising. And we invite sometimes up to 60 other organizations in to showcase animals and their rescue, as well as the city shelters, county shelters, that kind of thing. So it's by super adoption, it's just a big Magilla of an adoption event with, upwards of 1,000 animals at any given time, runs for a couple of days over the weekend, and it will find homes for as many as 600 dogs and cats from the various organizations. Now, Ricky Shoreham there in Jacksonville has picked that up and is doing great work with that as well, and he calls them mega adoptions. So he's gone one better.
Wow. Okay. The rhetoric the rhetoric is escalating wildly. I don't know where you go beyond mega, but
I guess.
Yeah. But and as you might know, Francis Rick's been a guest on the show, and he's had quite a track record there. So I guess that entitles him to say mega. But now back to sort of the more recent part of the sort of narrative that you've told so far. In terms of the false starts that you alluded to, were those in your mind strictly due to the sort of constant turnover you described in terms of the general managers there, or what were some of the other factors in the false starts being, in fact, false starts as opposed to sort of taking hold?
Well, I think that the environment in Los Angeles had been very contentious, and so there were some elements within the rescue community. I mean, if you look at the history and what was happening with the different general managers. We haven't agreed with all general managers, but, we have worked with all the general managers. And what the situation has been was that some of the general managers really were not doing a very good job and took an awful lot of fire. And so they, and there were protests and demonstrations and, red spray paint on people's cars and smoke bombs in their lobby of their hotels or their apartments. But, it was crazy. It was very, very dysfunctional.
Yeah.
So that certainly didn't help anything. And so people kind of, developed sort of a bunker mentality from the point of view of some of the officials. Within the wider community, there was, at the time, we didn't have the resources that we do now to be able to really fund in a big way the kind of programs that we needed. So it depended a lot on other sources, and looking at that kind of mess from the outside, there weren't a lot of sources that were interested in sort of jumping into that. So there was a combination of things. The big thing, though, was the fact that the revolving door at GM, and so even a bad plan couldn't get started, you know, let alone a good plan. So things were, this wasn't a receptive environment.
So it really sounds like Brenda's arrival, given that sort of history and backdrop there, was the key catalyst for this really having a chance to
well,
take.
Well, it was because she had the no-till credibility. She'd worked in no-till. She, you know, worked under Rich Avedino. She had built the Seattle Humane Society into a no-till organization and set the trail there for what is now a no-till city, pretty much. And so she came in with cred, and that got her bought goodwill, and you know, everybody put up the white flag and, you know, got to work. It's not been without contest, but it allowed things to get going.
Right. It sounded like people were gun shy and frustrated, and had been down some roads before. Were willing or more willing to take this seriously and give it a shot based on the fact that Brenda was now at the helm and the kind of background that she brought to it.
Exactly. And now, I don't want to, you know, give anybody the impression that Brenda is, you know, is universally loved. And, you know, no one is without controversy or something that somebody doesn't like or said something or did something or has, you know, in 1983, you know, whatever. You know what I mean? So everybody's...
Yeah. Well, you can't be in that job anywhere and not have some sort of mixed response, people with very strongly differing views. Yeah, no matter what your history is or whatever you have done previously to arriving at that position. That just seems to be the nature of this particular beast.
Yeah. And what she's done really has been really working on, you know, the only thing that really she has under her control, which is policy and culture within animal services. And that has been something that, you know, it takes time. It's, you know, it was a situation where it hadn't been managed. It hadn't been run. Here's somebody coming in actually imposing order, attempting to kind of manage a situation that had either had been really self-governing for good or for ill, and having someone come in who actually had a vision, an intention, a direction, and trying to make that work. And it's also, you know, it's a union shop in Los Angeles. And so what Best Friends was able to do on the other side of that was to come in with enough resources to pull together the rescue community to start to provide direction for the whole community. And she provided the cooperation and support, policy, and, again, beginning to work within the, you know, change the culture within that institution.
Oh, great. Well, now you're getting into some of the mechanics that I definitely really wanted to explore. Let me just let folks know really quickly. This is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, my guest is Francis Batista, a co-founder of Best Friends Animal Society, which in 2012 helped launch a no-kill LA initiative in Los Angeles that's yielded significant results. If you'd like to ask Francis a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663 or email dj@wmnf.org. And actually, Francis, before we forge ahead, you know, all kidding aside about the terms like super adoption and mega adoption, I mean, there are some rhetorical things in this that people who may not be as steeped in it. Why don't we define really what no kill means, just because the term suggests one thing, and as great a goal as it might be, it's not really what it exactly sounds like. So maybe you could really specifically sort of address what no kill means in this context.
Well, no-kill, as is generally accepted in our world and our movement, is when no animals are being killed in municipal shelters for a reason other than the fact that an animal will have really no quality of life. So unless an animal is truly suffering either physically from disease, injury, age, to where they are, there's no reasonable treatment for them, that they they don't have any condition that will respond. They are really truly in a situation that euthanasia is euthanasia. It's not a good mercy killing. It's not something where they're being killed for convenience, population control, shelter space, time in the shelter, any of those things. And it includes all animals. We talk about noses in, noses out. Nothing is qualified as, well, this might be adoptable or that might not be adoptable, or, you know, big dogs aren't adoptable here, or pit bulls aren't adoptable. None of that. The target goal, the threshold, is regarded as 90%. That doesn't mean that that 10% of all the animals fall into that other category, but that's when you really hit the threshold where you really are dealing with the majority of animals. It's very good work. You can identify a community as really sort of putting their shoulder to the wheel. And so the threshold for a no-kill community is considered to be 90%. You know, most do better than that. And so our target goal, our sort of where we're aiming for, is that 90%. That's not the end of it, but that's kind of the
quest.
The quest, and that sort of rarefied air in that 90% range. There are about 230-some communities in the United States that operate within that range. And, you know, most of them are smaller. I think the largest city is Austin, Texas, which is doing great work. They're at about a 93% save rate. The largest community, single jurisdiction, is one of the suburbs of Washington, D.C. in Virginia, which is, I think, you know, in that, but that's kind of one of the wealthiest communities in the country, with the average family income is over six figures, you know, so it's they vary. But, you know, Reno, Nevada is one of the other larger places. But there are a lot of small, medium communities around the country that fall into this, and they're about, you know, 19 or 20 in Utah as a result of the work that was done there. And you know, there are, you know, that doesn't mean that all the everywhere else it's kind of really lousy. There are a lot of communities that are making great progress. So this has really gone from being a fringe idea back when Best Friends started and Rich Avanzino was doing his thing in San Francisco to really being the mainstream approach to this. It's still, you know, there are other views out there, but this has really taken over the conversation.
And Francis, speaking of Maddie's Fund, to what extent, once Brenda had arrived and this seemed like it really you guys were each kind of seeking each other to make something like this work, to what extent was the Mayor's Alliance of NYC's Animals sort of examined either as a sort of model or inspiration for No Kill LA?
Well, it wasn't really, because we had our own that, you know, the No More Homeless Pets in Utah was the first statewide, and I think only statewide, Maddie's Fund grant, and that was a Best Friends operation. So we had, you know, experienced that with that, and we just pulled that off the shelf. You know, now, also back in the day, Best Friends was one of the initial funders of the Mayor's Alliance before it had traction, and not in a big way. We just, you know, helped keep the lights on for a couple of years there as they were pulling together their coalition. So we were certainly familiar with it, but we had, you know, an in-house, on-the-shelf model that
sure.
we were pulling from. To Rich, and to Maddie's Fund, just on Maddie's Fund, to Rich's credit, you know, a lot of the work that you see now was about, you know, metrics and demonstrating proof of concept and really keeping records and showing results and positioning everything with regard to, well, how is this, how is this working? What is the benefit we're getting out of it? How many animals are being saved? You know, in the past, that was imposed on Maddie's Fund recipients by Maddie's Fund and Rich and the whole team there. Now, that's really become the accepted protocol for doing this kind of work. In the past, you did good work. You went out, you spayed and neutered, you did adoptions, you did, you know, whatever it might be. But the idea of the metrics were, you knew how many animals you were adopting, you knew how much spay and neuter you were doing. But the idea of really seeing the impact of this in a much more business-like way hadn't really been introduced into the movement. And you know, credit Rich for that.
Well, that makes sense. And there seems like there's echoes and through lines, I think, through some of these more notable programs and successes, partly because some of the people, some of the key figures are sort of winding in and out of them. But okay, so Brenda is there. You guys have been there. You guys find each other. So then this seems like there's a real chance to make something that's going to take hold, that's going to have traction, as you mentioned earlier. But still, sometimes it can be tricky to get two or three animal organizations to agree on an issue or policy, not to mention seed leadership on matters of any consequence. And you had noted earlier that, you know, there's a lot of sort of contentious stuff and bunker mentality. So how did you go about creating this coalition, given what was likely at least to involve turf battles and conflicting views about adoptions and no-kill and feral cats? I mean, that must have been a tall task coming into it.
Well, because of our... as I said, the relationship that we've had with the local community through, again, the super adoptions that we did, which in a sense are, you know, it's a coalition. A super adoption is really a de facto coalition. You know, everybody's in the park for a weekend doing the same thing, cooperating, you know, high-fiving, having a great time, saving a lot of animals. And so that kind of activity developed a sufficient reservoir of goodwill to... have the conversation and to get these things kind of at least folks open to hearing what we were talking about. And also, we best friends had developed sufficient resources to actually say, okay, here's what we're putting up. We've done do this, and we're going to, here's our part of this, and we're going to support this with in a big way. Another component of this the first meeting of the steering committee of this was, as you might imagine, a bit tense.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's kind of the scenario I, you know, imagined and that you see a lot of places. So how did you guys navigate through that then?
I think as we committed to listening, we said, look, here's our schemata for this, and we want you to help adapt it and apply it to the community here. And we trust your knowledge of the different aspects and personalities within the rescue community, the realities of the dynamics of the cities, the realities of the different sort of, what's needed in the different zip codes, what's needed in these various places. How do we take this model that we applied in Utah and implement it here in a way that makes sense for you guys? And so the fact that we were listening, everybody had a voice, everybody had a vote, and that really created, you know, a conversation, but it didn't happen overnight. I mean, we worked at this for about 6 months before we launched it to the wider community. And in that time, we also had some serendipitous things happen. And it just felt like, you know, the wind was at our back. One of the big things that came through was that, and we hadn't expected this or any idea that it was going to take place, but one of the city shelters, back in 2000, the city had a bond measure to either rebuild or build new all of the city shelters. And at that time, they built seven. So there were six that they kind of renovated or built new. And then there was a seventh that they just created. They divided the largest service district into two because it was huge and built another shelter in that area. However, they never had, and everybody knew this at the time, well, that's great, but where are you going to get the money to staff it? You know, you're talking about quantum leap in departmental staffing, which even at that time was a stretch. And then as the economy went south, it became a non-starter. So this beautiful building that was completed in 2007, just prior to it all hitting the fan, sat there until 2012 and was about to be, well, in 2011, was being about to be mothballed. So they put it out for an RFI or whatever they call those things, for to be run by somebody because they didn't want a mothball. It was expensive to do that, and they had a big investment in it. And so we threw our hat in the ring, and we got our proposal was approved by city council to operate that. And it was a big megilla having, you know, running one of those things. So that, but what that did was it provided this key component to the coalition, a full-blown modern shelter facility that Best Friends was operating that really provided a lot of the just critical mass to start making a dent in the shelter population. So Best Friends operates as a pet adoption and spay-neuter center, one of the city shelters, and it's a kind of a lease for services because it's a bond. It's a lot very complicated. It's a bond measure, so they can't lease it. They can only, you know, have to come to some kind of a use agreement for it to give it to a non-city agency to use. So we have that for on a 3-year contract with a 2-year option to renew, and that has made a tremendous difference.
Well, so Francis, I mean, talking about this sort of beautiful building and kind of how, you know, how it sort of became a Best Friends operation also makes me think when you were launching the coalition, and again there were some resistance here and there, or just some emotionally charged meetings, as there often are in these situations, were there financial sort of incentives for organizations to join the coalition and or to follow the directives of what was then becoming No Kill LA?
Yeah. And just to give you, I want to realize, as I'm speaking, I realize that, you know, I haven't really painted the full picture. So just briefly, when our baseline year, which is the year we were measuring as of comparing our results to, which is 2011, 56,000 animals came into the shelters, just to give you some idea of the scale of work there. And that doesn't even count the county of Los Angeles, which is another 60,000, 70,000 animals. So in the city of Los Angeles alone, 6 shelters, 56,000 animals, 23,000 were being killed. So our approach, a la the Maddie's Fund model, was to incentivize adoption, not shelter pulling, but adoption, and also to provide grants for economically targeted spay-neuter programs. So spay-neuter aimed at communities or individuals who would not otherwise have the resources to spay or neuter their pets. So our approach has been to offer $150 incentive per adoption over baseline. So, for example, Duncan's Rescue in 2011 adopted out 10 dogs from LA Animal Services. In 2012, you adopt out 15 dogs from LA Animal Services. We give you $150 per those five above the 10 for the previous year. So all incremental increases in adoption, we supplement and provide an incentive for that, but only for the ones that you pull from LA Animal Services. Now, we're not saying you can't do anything else. You're your own organization. You have your own protocols.
Sure.
Our guidelines are pretty simple. You need to be a no-kill organization. You need to be a 501c3. No bash and trash. If we have difficulties and differences, we work it out amongst ourselves. No going to war with each other, and keeping, you know, being willing to have audit on your, you know, not, audit is the wrong word, but you know, just show us your adoptions. If you know, spot check to make sure that we are actually providing money for work that's actually being done. It's been pretty straightforward. So it's really pretty simple, but it is a powerful incentive. And as the thing gains momentum, it becomes more powerful, again, not from even from the point of view of the subsidies, but those do make a difference. But there's a sense of esprit and achievement and a continually growing sense of, hey, we're really making a difference here.
And we're all in this together. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I may have sort of inadvertently buried the lead here. You started touching this, but let's really talk numbers for a sec. So to build on the numbers that you sort of introduced in terms of what the baseline was, let's talk about kind of where the numbers were just prior to launching No Kill LA, and then what has happened sort of in the ensuing couple of years.
Okay, and as you also alluded to, you know, there are some talk about No Kill, but it's, you know, technically absolutely technically not, you know, so we're saying that no animal is going to die. So we started this, there were 56,000 animals coming in, 23,000 dying. As of the end of 2013, 2 years into the program, the intake was down to 50,000, and the number of animals dying in the shelter went down from 23,000 to 14,000. When we talk about our no-kill goal of 90%, when we started, we were 17,000 short of that goal. So, you know, just that theoretic 90%, 17,000 more animals would have had to been saved in 2011 for the city to be considered a no-kill city. As of the end of 2013, only 9,000 more. So we went from 23,000 killed to 14,000 killed, and that 90% number went from 17,000 to 9,000.
And what, obviously we're not too far into 2014, but what does sort of the projections look like for this year?
Well, and, you know, when you start this, you have projections and targets, and you have your, here's your theoretic goal. We're going to do this year one, we're going to do this year two, year three, and then by year five, we are going to be at that 90%. So the good news is we're ahead of that, the metric so far for 2014.
So we're sort of nearing the end of our time, Francis, yet I feel like I have a few other notable questions, and we get some email questions, et cetera. But let me just ask now, where do feral cats figure into these numbers, or do they?
They do, and that was another thing. And one of the things that there are so many sort of layers of life in Los Angeles. In 2009, Bird Conservancy organization called Urban Wildland filed a suit against the city of Los Angeles, saying the city had not conducted an environmental impact study, which is required by California Environmental Quality Act, before they instituted their TNR program. Now, the feral cat program. The city went into court on the say-so of the then general manager, said, well, we don't have a feral cat program. And the plaintiff pulled up their website and showed the kind of the guidelines for TNR or their feral cat program that they had. And so, you know, they were basically, the city attorney was kind of hung out to dry by misinformation from then general manager.
Yeah.
And so the issue of TNR was not contested in court on the merits of TNR. It's simply the fact that we don't have a TNR program. Well, clearly you do have a TNR program, so the judge says, well, stop. So there's an injunction on the city of Los Angeles. Not people can do TNR, and everybody, you know, all of the rescues that are connected with this do. However, the city can't support it. So if you call about a feral cat problem, you're not, the city's going to tell you to call Great Cat Alliance, their best friends, or Kitten Rescue, or any of the cat organizations. Or they're not going to say, well, here are some resources, or here's a spay-neuter program. So the city is prohibited by this injunction from providing any support to the public for TNR. So that's one component. However, that said, Best Friends, or the coalition, does support TNR, and we fund various efforts. However, because we are operating out of one of the city shelters, we cannot mention or in any way support TNR out of that city building. So our TNR operations and support comes directly from Utah to local operatives. So we can't, you know, we can't
wow.
mention the word feral cat
yeah.
Out of that city shelter. So again, it's all a bit crazy.
Yeah, it sounds very circuitous, but it sounds like, I guess, because of that injunction, that's the only way to keep sort of the rest of the plates spinning is to sort of live by those rules.
And just a quick note of those 23,000 animals that were dead in that everything were kittens under the age of 8 weeks. So we instituted a kitten nursery, and last year we were able to pull about close to 1,800 kittens under 8 weeks with an 82% save rate, which is really high for neonatals that are coming in, some of them a couple of days old with no immune systems. But we're happy with that, and we're hoping to expand that. So yes, that is an issue. We're trying to address it from different angles. It would be great if the city could really get on board with it, but we're taking every step we can to compensate for that inability.
And is that why, because in sort of preparing to speak to you, obviously I wanted to be pretty up to speed in research and stuff. So I was interested to see that at least a couple years ago. Now, this may have changed. This is one of the reasons I want to ask you about it. But there seemed to be criticism from the No Kill LA initiative from Nathan Winograd. It's, at first glance, would seem to be kind of counterintuitive that a guy who was like an ambassador of No Kill would be critical of Best Friend's efforts in this regard. So is this directly hooked to the feral cat thing we just talked about, or is there other issues, or what is his position maybe at this point, which may have shifted?
His position of respect within the movement from all the work, has been very pretty much silent on the work of the coalition. I think generally supportive, and of Brenda, obviously. I don't know what that was about, and I do seem to recall there was something somewhere he says, Best Friends Sweep Feral Cats under the carpet, and I'm not sure what that was related to. I remember the little kind of image that was associated with it and the term, but I actually don't know what it was about, and I'm not quite sure I even understand it, but I understood it at the time.
Yeah, well, I just in my probably limited understanding, it seemed like kind of the thing that we just discussed, the sort of injunction that prevents sort of more direct involvement with TNR and therefore dealing with feral cats, struck him as sort of a major sort of snag in the...
Well, sure, but I don't think he laid that at our door or even at NKF's door. He knew what that was because it was in place prior to that. There may have been something that appeared to be selling the ferals short, but I assure you we've done everything we conceivably can to support ferals, including we have our own something called Free Fix LA, which is targeted operation by our staff on the ground operating under folks out of Utah. We support Fix Nation, which is the only freestanding Fix clinic exclusively for cats, feral cats primarily. That was created by some of our volunteers. So I think, if you dig down into it, we have done pretty well in that regard, although obviously there's a lot more.
Yeah, well, and the other thing, just in our last moment here, Francis, is that this just points to, and one of the things I find so interesting about these kinds of discussions is that No Kill and efforts in that direction seem to always be some sort of sized lightning rod for criticism. I mean, about the only time over the years I've been sort of gotten pretty harshly criticized for the show is when I've had a no-kill advocate or expert on, and the criticism usually declares, I've been duped, or that I'm too dumb to understand the reality or the nuances of the situation. So it seems like people are, that other opposition is, very spirited and but I hope and I certainly feel less dumb after our conversation today. So that's progress. But it is striking though how sort of vehement some of the opposition is.
Animal welfare is like Christianity in that baptized by immersion or baptism by sprinkling? Do you believe in this? You know what I mean? So there is, it's so passionate, so close to home, and everyone involved in it. I respect everybody's kind of opinion and commitment in this line of work because it is very demanding and very taxing. It is very, very, people are incredibly passionate and it's entirely understandable. But I think where I depart from some of this is that there are still people out there who think that a no-kill is unsustainable, is just an illusion, and I absolutely disagree with that.
Yeah.
There's no reason we should be killing our best friends in shelters. It's just a black mark on our society, on not just on animal welfare, on our communities. How do you have, how can you kind of be proud of a community that's killing household members? These are household members. How can you feel good about a community that's killing your incredible
table? Right, and really, whatever, yeah, and whatever the sort of emotions or different points of view are, I mean, sometimes just, if nothing else, you just sort of look at the numbers, and, that I think is kind of hard to ignore hard, tangible results, so... So, Francis, we are over time. I'm sorry to keep you longer than I promised, but it was such a fascinating conversation. We've been speaking with Francis Batista from Best Friends Animal Society. The Best Friends website is bestfriends.org. The website devoted to no-kill LA is nkla.org. Francis, thanks for joining us again to Talking Animals, and we definitely
And keep an eye out for Save Them All. That's our call to action. Save them all.
Absolutely, yeah. We had a conversation about that. I can't think of her name from Jacksonville, but yeah, right. We'll keep track of that as well. So thank you, Francis, once again.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. All right, let's check into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner. This is Jake Johansson with the first part of a piece called Whale Watching on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
Last year, I took my family on a vacation. We thought it was a good idea. We were going to go whale watching. And right, which I thought was a good idea, because I'm from the Midwest, I'm from Iowa, where whale watching was not on the menu. You could go cow watching, which does not sound that good, but let me tell you something. When you go cow watching, you see some damn cows. Right? That's right off the bat, you know where the cows are, and you go there, and they're there. And then you look at them until you're done. And so that's what I thought whale watching was going to be like. I thought, well, someone knows where the whales are, and we're going to go there, and we're going to watch them, right? That's what they call it. And they're so big, right? How can you miss them? Whales are so big. Well, whales are big, but you know what else is big? The Pacific Ocean. It turns out that thing is really big compared to the amount of whales that are in it. When you look at it that way, like, for example, I think hypothetically they could take all the whales out of the ocean and it wouldn't really go down that much, right? Well, that's what I'm saying. It wouldn't be like you went to the beach and felt like, well, did someone take the whales out of here? It's low. You wouldn't even know. But we were not thinking like that when we made the plan. We were optimistic. We thought we'll pay our it was $50 each to go on a 3.5-hour whale watching excursion. That's what they call it, excursion. And I thought this is going to be great. You know, we're going to be sick of looking at whales after 3.5 hours. And they don't tell you that three people are going to throw up the whole time. Seasick, right? And it turned out my daughter was the first person to throw up. Right, she's 8, and we were 20 minutes in to the 3.5-hour trip. I know, I felt terrible as a parent. I didn't see it coming, and of course, her attitude about whale watching, 180. Yeah, as soon as she threw up, she was like, Daddy, I do not want to go whale watching anymore. I want to go back to the dock, make them turn the boat around, and then I had to explain to her, well, I'm sorry, honey, but everyone else pay to go whale watching. So now I'm explaining capitalism to an 8-year-old while she's throwing up. So that is a tough sell.
All right. That was Jake Johansson with the first part of a piece called Whale Watching, taken from his most recent appearance on Letterman. We'll hear the other half of that Letterman set in next week's Comedy Corner. We have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals. We'll be back next Wednesday when my guest will be Laura Fletcher Taylor, co-founder of Loving Friends Transport, which transports animals from overcrowded shelters in one part of the country to shelters in another part where they stand a much better chance of being adopted. They also transport animals from crisis situations like puppy mill raids, hurricanes, hoarding cases, and more. Hope you'll join me for that next Wednesday. Also, we'll be visiting our website, talkinganimals.net. There's all kinds of information, links. Again, you can sign up for the email newsletter and Facebook page, Twitter, the whole shebang. I'm Duncan Stress. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. Alternative Radio is next on WMNF. We'll look for you back here next Wednesday at 9 a.m. on Talking Animals at WMNF, Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwachi, and beyond. Thanks.